Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of our favorite authorities on these matters is Congressman Chris Stewart of the 2nd District of Utah, the man who has distinguished himself both in uniform and out in any number of ways, notably as an Air Force command pilot who set the world record for around-the-world travel at high speeds in a B-1 aircraft. He is also the author of some 17 books, including New York Times bestsellers, and now a distinguished member of the House Appropriations Committee and House Intelligence Committee. And always welcome here, Congressman. Good to have you with us, sir. Thanks for joining us.
And it is always good to be with you, Frank. Thank you so much.
There's so much to talk about. We are in need of your intelligence on what we're doing at the moment in terms of this deal with Iran. On the one hand, John Kerry said over the weekend that he's prepared to walk away if it's not a good deal. There seems to be no reason to believe it will be a good deal. What's your sense, Congressman?
Well, it was a bad deal when we reached the final stages of negotiation 2 months ago. I have no reason to believe it's any better. In fact, I have reason to believe it's probably worse. And, you know, when you refer to Secretary Kerry's statement about, yeah, we may walk away, I mean, no one believes that. This is the president's most important foreign policy goal and objective of, I would say, his entire administration, not just the second term. And it's like when the secretary and others say all options are on the table. No one believes that either. You know, we believe they want this deal desperately, that they're willing, in my opinion, to endanger our own national security interest in order to achieve it. And it's terribly, terribly worrisome for us.
In your professional judgment, both as a former Air Force officer and now as a member of the Intelligence Committee, is there any chance that what will come out of this deal actually advances that goal, or is it much more likely that we're going to see not only Iran with a nuclear weapons capability, but also a host of other countries that will respond by getting their own?
Yeah, and in fact, Frank, you hit upon, I think, the most critical consideration in this whole process, and that is it may no longer matter what you and I think about this deal. It may not matter any longer what the president or what Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks about this deal. What it may come down to is what do the Saudis think about this, because they simply will not allow their rival and their adversary in the area, who have been so for generations, they will not allow the Persians to develop nuclear weapons. They just simply won't. And if the Saudis believe that this process will allow them that pathway, and in a few short years, they're simply going to do it themselves as well and more quickly. And then so will Turkey, and then so will Egypt, and then so will some of the other Gulf states. And my great fear is that we have maybe let the genie out of the bottle already. I don't know how you put it back. And in 5 years, we may have an entirely nuclearized Middle East. And, oh, my heavens, can you imagine dealing with the security implications if that were the case?
Yeah, you know, they would be pretty bad, Congressman Chris Stewart, if the present regimes in all of those countries had nuclear weapons. I think there's no getting around it. Most of them are jihadist in character, if not overtly so, certainly in terms of what they're doing behind the scenes. But if the no-kidding jihadists who make no bones about their enmity towards us and are seeking our destruction were to come to power in the states where they're not already, with nuclear arsenals at their beck and call, this is a vastly more dangerous world. I can only shudder at the thought. Let me talk about the president's ruminations at the Pentagon yesterday after taking stock with his senior military leaders about the so-called war against the Islamic State. What did you make of his comments, Congressman, that you cannot defeat an ideology with military means, but only with better ideas?
It makes me cringe because it shows, in my opinion, the overall the naivety of this administration that's been demonstrated now for almost the 7 years that he's been in office. Look at history, Frank. For heaven's sakes, what would have happened, and it sounds so simplistic, but it's so true. What would have happened in World War II if we had taken that frame of mind? If we'd said, we can't defeat them militarily, we have to defeat them through our superior ideology. Would that have been the outcome? Do you think that we could have persuaded this evil, evil regime of Nazi Germany to see our point of view? Move that argument forward to now. It is just as unlikely that these nations and these people who have sworn to defeat us, to destroy us, who have demonstrated the most vicious and cruel manner of treating each other, and to say we're going to go persuade them to come to our way of thinking by providing them with jobs, it just is insane to me to think that you wouldn't recognize this fact that at some point national security may require the use of arms.
And it's compounded further, I think it's fair to say, Congressman Chris Stewart, again, of the Appropriations and Intelligence Committees, that we are looking at people who regard our moral equivalence between their brand of violent extremism and others, I don't know, anti-abortion activists or environmentalists or what have you, as further evidence of our rot and ultimate, destiny of being defeated by them. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, it's no question that's true, and it's one of the great consequences of our national security and our foreign policy over the last few years is that our allies see us as weak. They don't know that they can depend on us anymore, and believe me, I know that it's true. I've had personal conversations with the leaders of these nations who used to view us as their strongest ally and no longer do, and at the same time, our enemies view us as weak as well.
It emboldens the latter, for sure, and can only alienate the former, which is a formula, it seems to me, for having a lot more enemies and a lot fewer friends. Congressman, let me turn, speaking of people who are pretty hostile to us, it turns out, Communist China is, as best we can tell, the agent behind the now 18 million, we're told, personnel files that have been compromised in the hacking of the Office of Personnel Management databases. What do you make of that? And Congressman, what do you say? I mean, in Utah, you have a lot of data centers these days, including those of the federal government. What do you say to people who are concerned that other data that they're being asked by the government to surrender, perhaps their personal medical histories, for example, may be compromised as well?
Yeah, well, we already know that some of the systems with Obamacare have been compromised. They were compromised within the first few months of coming online. And it was one of the things that Congress sought to address and sought to hold the administration accountable for. But I think people have reached a point where I think they have to assume that if they've got private or personal information online, that it's subject to being breached. And you know, as you've mentioned a couple times, I was an Air Force pilot. I held one of the most senior or the most highest level of top secret security clearance that's available. I know what intensely personal and what extensive information is based in those security background checks. Heavens, they went back and talked to people that I knew in high school that I could hardly remember. And to think that that type of information has been breached now. And there's a reason for this as well. We need to recognize the Chinese didn't do this randomly. They specifically, if it was China, whoever it was, they specifically targeted this type of information. And it allows them access to all sorts of things to us. Who might be potential intelligence agents working for us? Who might they recruit to provide intelligence to them? Who might they blackmail? And in fact, Frank, as I mentioned to you, we've written an editorial that will be released in the next few days saying we need to have a real conversation about how do we respond with these types of breaches, because I don't think we yet have a strategy for doing so.
I think we're a long way from that. And in fact, the failure of the Office of Personnel Management, Congressman Stewart, to take steps to correct problems that they had earlier been warned of, it makes this just that much more evidence of malfeasance. Just very quickly, we have less than half a minute. Your assessment of this as a counterintelligence challenge, Congressman?
Yeah, well, it's no question it is, as I've indicated here before. And if I could just back up again to your comment about OPM, has anyone been held accountable for this yet? Does anyone step forward and said, this is my responsibility, I failed to protect this information, and I will take appropriate steps, including holding myself accountable? No one's done that. And that's one of the great challenges we have in the federal government, is that happens so rarely.
Yeah. Well, I'm told that the woman in charge of OPM these days is pretty good on diversity training, but maybe not so good on anything else. Congressman Chris Stewart, thank you very much, as always, for your service to our country, both that you've rendered in the past in uniform and that you're rendering today, representing the people of the 2nd District of Utah. Keep up the good work, sir, and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Pamela Tsai joins us. We'll talk about Chinese influence operations in the United States straight ahead.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined, I believe, for the first time by Pamela Tsai. She is the marketing director for an independent Chinese media in the United States. It's known as the Epic Media Group. She comes to us to talk, among other things, about what's going on in China, but also how we're being encouraged to perceive what's going on and our general relationship with communist China. Pamela, welcome. It's very good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, for having me. Great to be here.
Well, let's start by just taking stock, if we can, Pamela, as to what's going on in China. It certainly is the case that there are economic challenges, the stock market plummeting by roughly a third of its value, the Chinese acting ever more aggressively, among other places, in the South China Sea. Are these manifestations, in your judgment, of real turmoil inside the political system in China, not just isolated problems confronting the Chinese government at the moment?
Well, Frank, I think you're absolutely right. What's going on in China, especially the political massive changes, are affecting the stock market, the foreign policy, and the domestic policy. Since Xi Jinping came into power in November 2011, he has started a relentless campaign to dismantle the former Communist Party leader Jiang Zemin's political influence and economical structure. So what you're seeing here in China is that the old regime is completely gone, and Xi Jinping has to follow the will of the Chinese people. And what's going on in China is, as of today, there are more than 200 million Chinese people have publicly abandoned communism because of a publication that we launched 10 years ago. It's called Nine Commentaries on Communist Party. So many people say it's the Chinese equivalent of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in 1776. So China is going through a lot of great changes. And so I think America should be prepared to welcome a new and free China and encourage the new Chinese government to be more open and become more responsible player in a global society.
We're visiting with Pamela Tsai. She is the marketing director for an important independent Chinese media called Epic Media Group. I believe it is fair to say it is associated with a very important dissident movement within China, the Falun Gong. And Pamela, it's clearly the case from what you've described that there are opportunities, it would seem, for real change in China if 200 million people are demonstrating their opposition to the regime. That's kind of a problem. But how is the Chinese government dealing with these political difficulties, particularly in terms of its campaign to influence how foreign audiences, notably ours, perceive China and what's going on there at the moment?
Well, Frank, I think what's going on in China is that nothing can stop China from becoming free. And the new Chinese government is trying to distance the new administration from the old regime headed by Jiang Zemin, who is the most suppressive regime in the modern Chinese history. And so what I'm going to talk about is that they're also trying to infiltrate in the American society. So we're talking about what's happening here. So if you look at all the Chinese media in the United States, they're either directly controlled or heavily influenced by Beijing. So and many people here are not speaking Chinese and not consuming Chinese media, so they couldn't tell the difference. But we're seeing every day that the anti-America and pro-communist, ideology and propaganda is having, a major impact on the U.S. media industry and especially in the advertising industry. And most of the corporate America's advertising, they're actually putting their marketing dollar and advertising investment in the Beijing's mouthpiece here in the United States and suffocating the growth of America's own independent Chinese language media like Epoch Times and New Tang Dynasty Television. And so Epoch Media Group was actually founded by a group of Chinese Americans who wanted to find a new independent Chinese media completely independent, free from Beijing's control and censorship.
And Pamela, as an American looking at China through this lens, it's hard to, I guess, not only discern what's being done here, but the kind of implications it has when companies that are beholden to Beijing for access to China, to do business there, to have a reasonable chance of actually profiting, they're really, it sounds, being manipulated into not only putting their advertising dollars into Beijing's mouthpieces, but also to sort of hew to the party line, I imagine. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. To give you an example, when there's, say, U.S. government is charging the Chinese military for cyber attack against Pentagon and U.S. industry and business community. And if you read the pro-Beijing publication in America, you can see that there are articles directly supplied by the propaganda office in Beijing and accusing America of being the world's largest thief of economic intelligence and cyber attack. And if you're also reading the independent Chinese media like Epoch Times and New Tang Dynasty Television, again, we're reporting what's the fact. And then so when it comes to reporting the facts, there's actually, you can tell the difference between the pro-Beijing publication and America's own independent Chinese media. So what happened is that many American companies rely on Asian advertising agency to evaluate the Chinese media outlets in the U.S. And most of the times, those Asian advertising agencies are either operated by Chinese natives or people who are heavily influenced by Beijing. So they're actually acting on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing to advocate for the Beijing's mouthpiece for the corporate America's marketing and advertising dollar. And so there have been blocking independent Chinese media like New York Times, NTD TV and Epoch Times for 15 years. And so that's a problem, because do we want America companies to provide financial support for Beijing's mouthpiece to strengthen suppression of freedom of information and freedom of press on U.S. soil? And again, we're not talking about liberating China or helping to improve China's human rights or press freedom situation. We're talking about staying true to American value.
And I guess one of the things that most of us don't really understand, but I'm sure you do, given your experience with communism in China, is the importance to the regime of the kind of legitimacy that it garners from these sorts of influence operations, their ability to manipulate our perceptions, actually have an impact perhaps on American policy, whereas we might be supporting opposition elements like those you're associated with in pursuit of a free China. Instead, we are, I guess the technical term for it is kowtowing to Beijing and helping to prop up this regime. Pamela Tsai, this is an enormously important topic, and I appreciate very much the chance to visit with you a bit about it, because I think that, again, we don't really even understand the sort of ground truth in China, let alone have an opportunity to discuss it as we need to in the absence of the kind of free flow of information and truthful information that I know you are working to advance at Epic Media Group. Thank you so much for what you're doing and for taking a little bit of time to talk with us about it. We'll look forward to continuing this conversation with you in the future. Next up, Oren Kessler, an Egypt expert, talks about Bloody Wednesday and what it means for us as well as Egypt. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Secretary of State John Kerry recently lied that he and President Obama were prepared to walk away from a bad deal with Iran. How do we know?
Aside from the fact that his lips were moving, a telltale sign, White House officials yesterday urged 100 leftist activists to lobby for the deal they described as the president's, quote, signature foreign policy accomplishment, unquote. He isn't going to walk away from that. The lobbying campaign is being led by the Plowshares Fund, a foundation that has put millions behind its efforts to rid the world of nuclear weapons. Its support for a deal that will not only ensure Iran gets the bomb, but so do a host of other countries in the region, proves that the real objective of the radical left has always been to rid the world of American nuclear weapons, not those in the hands of her enemies. President Obama has demonstrated that he will do anything to get an agreement with Iran. So will his political allies. The American people don't want a bad deal, and Congress must reject the one that's coming. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at irantruth.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by the Deputy Director for Research at a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He is Oren Kessler, and he has also been associated in the past with another of my favorite organizations, this one in the United Kingdom, the Henry Jackson Society, where he was a Middle East Research Fellow. A man with long expertise, both as a journalist in Israel and in the think tank world, in matters involving what we wanted to talk with him about today, namely what is going on in Egypt at the hands of jihadists who have neither the interests of the Egyptian people, it would seem, nor ours, needless to say, in mind. Oren, welcome. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been writing and, needless to say, thinking a lot about the unraveling security situation in Egypt. There was a Bloody Wednesday event recently. Talk a bit about that as kind of a prism, perhaps, through which to look at what's happening more broadly.
Well, on Wednesday, the local Islamic State affiliate, it's a group that used to be called Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, but pledged allegiance to Islamic State, late last year, they launched an attack of sort of unprecedented sophistication and deadliness. They ended up killing about 70 Egyptian troops, policemen and security forces, and a few civilians. The attack was launched in about 15 places at once in the North Sinai near the border with Gaza, and Israel. And crucially, they took over land. They took over the second biggest town in the Sinai for the very first time, and they held it for several hours before the Egyptian forces were able to get them out of there. So just the scope of this attack, its sophistication, and the fact that they've taken territory for the first time is what makes this particularly significant.
The degree to which this was a frontal assault, if I can use that expression, on the Egyptian military suggests, and one conducted by the Islamic State to boot, suggests not only a greater degree of sophistication and capability, Oren Kessler, but also a willingness to challenge directly the authorities of Egypt. Are we seeing that sort of challenge elsewhere, if not at the hands of the Islamic State, those of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, much in evidence in Egypt even still?
So just 2 days before this bloody Wednesday, there was another hugely significant incident in which the Islamic State, apparently it was the Islamic State, killed Egypt's top public prosecutor. This is someone on the level of the attorney general here in the U.S. He was traveling in an affluent neighborhood of Cairo, and he was assassinated in a massive car bombing. And Islamic State subsequently took responsibility for this. So what we're seeing is, whereas these attacks from Islamic State and its predecessor were once mainly confined to the Sinai Peninsula, we're seeing more and more of this violence spreading into the mainland, into Egypt's populous heartland. And you asked about the Muslim Brotherhood. From the perspective of the Egyptian government, these are all essentially tentacles of the same animal. Cairo,
which happens to be an accurate assessment, don't you think?
Cairo has consistently described the Muslim Brotherhood as the progenitor of all of these Islamic extremist groups, and historically, I would agree with you, Frank, that it's hard to disagree with that. Many of these groups, jihadist groups, consistently cite people like Sayyid Qutb, the Brotherhood visionary, as it were, or ideologue. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, his roots are in the Brotherhood in Egypt. But as far as Cairo is concerned, these are all essentially, this is one great enemy. And you'll often hear things from Cairo to the effect of, well, whatever you call it, Islamic State, Muslim Brotherhood, al-Qaeda, it's all the same. So Egypt essentially accuses the Brotherhood of working directly with Islamic State. I'm not sure that's the case. The extent to which the Brotherhood is actively pursuing violence against the authorities in Egypt, it remains unclear. There seems to be some of it, but it seems to be in large part the work of rogue actors. It's unclear whether the Brotherhood leadership has actually made the decision to wage a violent uprising or campaign against the government.
Let me ask you about what's going on now vis-a-vis Hamas, the other arm of the Muslim Brotherhood operating in Gaza. The Egyptian government has, of course, closed most, if not all, of the tunnels that were used to supply Gaza with arms from Iran and elsewhere. Is the evidence, and I think you've reported to this effect, now that Hamas is working with the Islamic State in Sinai? And if so, how are they doing that under the noses of the Egyptian authorities?
So that is the accusation that Israel has leveled, that Israel has concrete information that Hamas helped Islamic State, habitually helps Islamic State, and perhaps helped Islamic State in this particular bloody Wednesday attack. I'm still looking into the details of that. I'm still looking for clarity on how exactly that worked, according to the Israelis. Egypt and Israel are working extremely closely. And this is all sort of under the radar. It's not done publicly, but the two countries are working extremely closely on the intelligence front, on the security front, to secure the Sinai. And in fact, there are rumors in Egypt, and these are rumors which can't be dismissed out of hand, that it was actually the Israelis who conducted the F-16 strikes on Wednesday against Islamic State in the Sinai. These strikes were so precise that even Egyptians who habitually accuse Israel of indiscriminate force and against Gaza said, you know what, this can't be the work of our own Air Force. This must be Israeli.
Only they're that good. We're again speaking with Oren Kessler of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's its deputy director for research. He is also a former reporter for the Jerusalem Post and also worked at the Haaretz English edition in Israel. So you have a good sense, needless to say, Oren, of how all of this looks from the Israeli side of the border. Sinai, of course, was part of the territory that was relinquished subsequent to the Camp David Accords. Do you think Israelis are reconsidering the advisability of having turned over this vast area? And may I ask also, is there a concern for the multinational forces, including ours, that have been placed there if this jihadism continues to accelerate?
I'll take the second question first because it's the shorter answer. The international forces in the Sinai, about half of which tends to be U.S. forces, has come under attack on a number of occasions. For the most part, emerged unscathed, but my understanding is that it is sort of hunkering down. It's not conducting the patrols as widely as it used to. It's spending more and more time on its base. There have been mortar attacks on its base, and I actually, last year, I spoke to the head of that organization, and there was certainly a sense of concern on their part, not panic. Nobody's talking about packing up and leaving, but there's certainly concern. They're fairly vulnerable out there. The Sinai is a large and desolate place, and they're certainly concerned. As for your first question, namely Israelis' perceptions of the Sinai and whether it was a mistake to make peace with Egypt, look, it's undeniable that every piece of land, every territory that Israel has withdrawn from, has become a terror springboard. We now see that with Sinai, but previously, of course, we saw that in South Lebanon, which is now controlled entirely by Hezbollah. We've seen that in the Gaza Strip, which Hamas has taken over. And of course, there's a tremendous potential for that to happen in the West Bank should Israel pull out completely. However, I think it's a fairly consensus issue, at least with the Sinai, that in Israel, that it was the right move to make.
And I'm sure that feeling is greater today with Morsi out and El-Sisi in Egypt and the kind of cooperation that you're talking about. Oren, we're over time. I'm afraid we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. This story, I'm afraid, is going to continue to unfold, as will other parts of your portfolio in the Middle East. Keep up the good work at FDD, and we'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Cliff Kincaid joins us next. We'll talk about Obama's mentor straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Cliff Kincaid, the president and founder of America's Survival and also the director of the Accuracy in Media Center for Investigative Journalism, is our guest. One of the great investigative journalists of our time, needless to say. He is an author of myriad incredibly interesting books, including Why You Can't Trust the News. And one of the places where I think the news has been seriously deficient, and I know you do too, Cliff, is in terms of exposing the American people, particularly back in the first presidential campaign of Barack Obama, to Mr. Obama's very problematic personal history and mentors.
Let's talk first and foremost about some recent revelations about one of those mentors, arguably his most important, Frank Marshall Davis.
It's a fascinating story, Frank, as you know, that, as you say, goes back to the first presidential campaign where we discovered that Obama, as a young man in Hawaii, had been mentored by a member of the Communist Party who had been under surveillance by the FBI for 19 years, a suspected Soviet agent, an espionage agent by the name of Frank Marshall Davis. We tried like mad to get this story out. It wasn't very successful. We couldn't even buy advertising on the Drudge Report at the time to alert people to what was going on. And here we are six, seven years later, and we're still struggling. But I think by this point, a lot of people see the pieces of the puzzle coming together.
What do you make of it? What kind of influence did an avowed, prominent, and, you know, very much worrying communist like Frank Marshall Davis have in the way of influence and impact on an impressionable young man like Barack Obama?
This is a guy, Davis, who was basically Obama's mentor for 7 to 8 years of his life before he went off to college. And I think he had the major influence over our president, not only in economic terms. Many people think of Marxism as just an economic theory in terms of inequality and all the fighting the capitalists and all the rest of it, which is a hallmark of Obama, but also in terms of cultural Marxism, because many people forget that Davis was also a pedophile. We have the evidence of that. He wrote pornographic books. We see that in Obama's cultural policies, where during the Pentagon gay pride ceremony this year, Frank, you actually had a Pentagon general, a male general, get up there in front of an audience in the Pentagon and introduce his husband. And a transgendered Pentagon employee looked on. Well, needless to say, since then, we've had the gay marriage decision. The White House has been lighted up in rainbow colors. We've seen a cultural collapse in this country that is even more serious than Obama's imprint on our economic debacle and policies.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, there are national security sort of overtones to all of that, too. Your comment about the Pentagon experience is but one example. Let me ask you about Professor Gerald Horn and his revelations. What bearing does that have on your earlier findings and what we should be making of the kinds of policies the president is now pursuing across this broad front, Cliff Kincaid?
Gerald Horn is a professor at the University of Houston. Very interesting fellow, very radical, clearly a Marxist. I recently interviewed him for our show on America Survival TV on Roku. He is actually the guy, Frank, who back in 2007 had blown the whistle, so to speak, on the fact that Obama had a relationship with Frank Marshall Davis. Now, remember, in Obama's book, Dream from My Father, he only referred to Davis as, quote, Frank. But it was Gerald Horn who said that they were linked, that it was Frank Marshall Davis, and he predicted at this time, and remember, this was at Tamiment Library in New York, where he was speaking on behalf of the Communist Party USA, which had turned over its archives to the library there. He said that Obama would go down in history as somebody who made a difference, just like Frank Marshall Davis did.
Wow. There actually was a video that I've seen recently, Cliff Kincaid, of the young Barack Obama as the editor of the Harvard Law Review talking about Frank Marshall Davis, you know, rather more explicitly than he did in the book.
That is an interesting development. We found out about that video only recently. That was a video actually from 1995, at the time that Obama's book Dreams from My Father came out. This almost came out of nowhere, but it was an appearance of Obama at a Cambridge library when he was editor of the Harvard Law Review, in which he openly at that time talked about Frank being Frank Marshall Davis. And he said Frank Marshall Davis had, quote, schooled him on the nature of white racism, basically confirming what we had been reporting all these years. But of course, this video just suddenly surfaced 7 years later.
Cliff, let me just point it boldly here. Do you think that what we've got in the White House in President Obama is a kind of Manchurian candidate, a guy who clearly was imbued with these very radical and anti-American beliefs and policy predilections and is now implementing them?
I think clearly Obama is a Marxist in terms of economics and cultural policies. You know, it's funny, when I recently interviewed Gerald Horn, I asked him about his speech back in 2007, identifying Frank Marshall Davis and Obama. And I said, what do you think about the impact that he's had? And Horn said, oh, well, yeah, I wouldn't say he is a Manchurian candidate, but Horn said that at the same time, he couldn't understand why the media didn't put two and two together and figure out that Frank was Frank Marshall Davis back there in 2008. And I said, well, we figured it out. We saw your speech. We reported it. He denied. He said, oh, no. You know, he's not a Manchurian candidate. And despite what Obama says about Davis schooling him on white racism, that he, Horn, said that Obama really hasn't been that radical. Well, I think Gerald Horn is disinforming, and he's got to be in his heart pretty pleased.
Well, pleased on the one hand, and certainly his view of what would be radical skews the curve, doesn't it? Hey, Cliff, let me turn to one other topic. And again, Cliff Kincaid is our guest from Accuracy in Media and American Survival. You are one of the country's living authorities on various communist operations and their implications. Very quickly, I've been talking with John Sitalides, one of our experts on Greece, about the proclivities of the government of Greece at the moment. And in particular, the possibility that if, in fact, things don't work out with Europe, which seems likely at the moment, there may be a new effort made with the Russians and Chinese to prop up Greece's economy and political system. What are your thoughts on that quickly?
I think that's clearly the case. And people ought to remember that it's not just the fact that Greece is a small country, 11 million people. The fact is that Greece is a strategically located country and member of NATO. I believe that Alexis Tsipras, the prime minister, is basically a Russian agent of influence. Putin's got control of that country today.
Mm. And if he does, the implications of this are all the more dire because in NATO's southeastern flank, we're not exactly braced up by Greece's neighbor, Turkey, which is also in rather unfriendly hands. Cliff Kincaid, as always, your insights into these and important matters and, of course, the clarity with which you lay out your case distinguishes your investigative reporting and your various books. We appreciate so much what you do. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.